I understand that it's not as easy to define what is fashion today as it was for the past, where you had a particular style. Okay, you can say it's the 1920s, it's 1930s, and then it's the 1980s. You can say that. But can you say it's the 2020s, it's the 2010s? Fashion is a cycle. It always feeds itself with the past and reingurgitates it with today's society. And what is today's society? Internet.
When I think about fashion, I think about my grandmother, and I think about how careful she was about what she wore, how it fit. And I also think about how she passed that down to me. So for this episode, I wanted to get into fashion today, why we wear what we wear, what the history of it is, and how you yourself can decide what it is that you want to experiment with. Because for me, my clothing is everything from comfort to a pep talk. It is often the one thing I can control in the morning. And so when I set out for the world, for a job, for a lecture, for even a recording like this, I think about what will make me feel the most confident. I mean, that's true for going out on dates too and having fun with friends. You know, it's practical as well as joyful. So that's why I wanted to get into it in this episode, where I'm very lucky to bring on a very special guest to our Pandora's Box. Her name is Catherine Fratan. She is an old friend of mine from my days in Istanbul. And she knows not only about the history of why we dress the way we do, but also she has a very international perspective on developing a personal and professional style. She is a marketing expert, a host of the bilingual fashion podcast, My Fashion Stories Box, as well as an instructor of fashion marketing and history at IFA Paris, an international fashion and design business luxury school based in Paris and Istanbul. So I'm very excited today to welcome on Catherine Fratan to the show. So let's welcome her. Catherine Fratan, welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you, Maria, for inviting me.
So we're talking today about fashion. And Catherine, we met actually because of fashion. You reached out to me for some content writing back when we were living in Istanbul.
Exactly. I was working for a Turkish footwear company, and the director was looking to translate the website in as many languages as possible. And in fact, it's him who found you. And then after we were exchanging messages, because he put me in contact with you so that I can do the follow-up. And basically, it's Istanbul and it's fashion. We can see that like that.
Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, aside from having been involved with the shoe company in Istanbul? Mm-hmm. How would you describe yourself?
I'm Catherine. I don't like to say that I'm French because this is not how I want to be defined. I don't consider myself as someone coming from one country. I've been living abroad for almost the majority of my life. I would say that I'm a person who is curious, who has been traveling, who has been learning and still is learning regarding history. And more like focusing on the past, try to understand the present and try to not to guess, but maybe to anticipate what could happen in the future. I've been working in marketing for a good part of my time in Moscow first. And then after, when I moved to Istanbul, I started to work in fashion.
And what got you interested in fashion to begin with?
Chance. I didn't have a big interest straight from the beginning. When I see my students, they are like 18 years old, sometimes 17 years old, and I want to work in the fashion industry. I want to be a designer. I want to be this and that. I wasn't like that. I discovered this field by chance, honestly. So I was not interested in all the glitters and glamours that you can find on social media, that you can see on fashion shows. I was more into what's happening behind, what are the skills, what are the people who are involved into creating these beautiful artifacts, these beautiful garments that people will wear, will copy. You have after all the process that we see pretty well. And by starting teaching for this fashion school in Istanbul, I've also been asked to teach a fashion history class. I never taught fashion history. I never taught history. I was more a marketing person. I love history. It's a topic that I like very much. Fashion, I started to understand. And so I said, why not? Let's try. And I discovered, in fact, a big passion for me. And it led me to do more research, to work not just on the history and how practices evolved from centuries to century. I also wanted to learn about the influence of the society, how the structure of the society, how the religion, how the cultures, how the beliefs, how the position of men, women, young people, older people influenced the way people were dressed and what was important for them to communicate about. So this nonverbal communication aspect linked with fashion and the sociology of fashion was what really started to interest me and still is nowadays.
I'm excited to get into all of that because this is why we're talking. But I always ask the guests this question at the start. If you could go back in time to your late 20s, what advice would you give yourself?
I would say don't pay attention to what people think of you. Because when I was younger and still a bit nowadays, I was really looking forward to have a validation from the others. It was a kind of reassurance that I was on the right tracks, that I was doing everything correctly. But in the end, you understand that you don't need that. But I was really looking to have people agreeing with me, to have people not judging me. And I would say that, yeah, pay attention to that. This is not the most important. They're not the one living your life. You are the one living your life. And this would be the advice I would give my younger self.
Can take a moment to get there. Speaking of making your own decisions, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you moved to Moscow and then you moved to Istanbul. And fashion varies so much country to country. And what we wear has a big signal on who we are to other people. And as you've said, the sociology of it. And we've both experienced this. How did you manage either maintaining or creating a personal and professional style as you went from Russia to Turkey and also back to France?
When I was a student, I just didn't pay attention to what I was wearing. It was not important. And because we didn't have money to spend on cool stuff, so it was hand-me-downs, it was secondhand, it was very cheap clothes because we didn't have the money to do it in another way. So I was not really putting efforts on how I would dress. It started to change when I moved to Moscow.
Oh.
I was working for the French office of a big French group, which had its headquarters in Paris, and I was working for the office in Moscow. And the marketing and communication director from Paris started to regularly come to Moscow because I was there to implement the marketing and communication. And one day she started to, you know, look me up and down. And just for the context, you have to imagine this very posh Parisian woman, very small, very thin, with heels. And she looked at you very judgmental. And she was, you know, Catherine, you have to work on your dress code. And I did some efforts on how I would look like. And it seems that it was not sufficient because I knew she was coming and she was Parisian and I don't come from Paris. So, you know, you have this kind of, we don't like Parisians. Parisians don't like us. So she left. And then after I went to see my managing partner, I said, oh, you don't know what she said to me. She said that I need to do some efforts because I don't dress well. And my managing partner was, you know, you do have to do some efforts. You are not a student anymore. You are a young professional. You are a representative, not just from France, but you're also a representative from a French company because I was going out a lot for networking events. So she said, she's right. She was right to tell you that. And it started to change, in fact. But did I work on a personal slash professional style? Not really. I was just copying. I was just taking inspiration from my colleagues, from my managing partner, to try to fit, you know. That's why I would say that my style was more like a kind of chameleon style, and as my personality is, in fact. You adapt. At least this is how I function. I adapt. I copy. I take inspiration.
Well, I think a lot of us do that anyway. It's very natural as human beings. We want to feel like we belong. And then especially if you're someone who thrives in living outside of your country of origin, we are people who are absolutely chameleons. That's how we survive. That's how we manage it. But I think it's interesting. It sounds like that moment, that really harsh truth telling.
You can't really imagine how I was like starting to get tired. I was
no, I can then, for sure.
But then after I developed a kind of passion, I would say I loved going shopping with my girlfriends, starting to take an interest into appearance. Our Russian girls, women were dressed when we are going out to parties, to clubs, and I wouldn't dress that way, but still, even if it's more unconscious level, you want to blend, so you copy. I started to wear short skirts, I started to wear high heels. In Istanbul, I wouldn't wear that. In France, I could wear high heels, it's just that it's not practical, I walk a lot. But in Moscow, it was fine because it was, you know, how girls my age wear dress, so I just copied.
Yeah, and we have to make 2 points, I think, about why don't you wear high heels in Istanbul, or rarely. A, the hills, which makes it impossible. You will kill yourself. And two, maybe some unwanted attention. There are certain venues in which you could wear high heels, but usually you see someone, or I remember seeing people with heels, and they almost always came in a taxi or with a chauffeur.
Exactly. It's true that moving to Istanbul, and I'm pretty sure you also experienced that, completely changed the way I was dressing. All the mini skirts, short skirts, heels that I was bringing with me, I would wear them very occasionally. If I would be picked up by taxi, if I knew I wouldn't have to cross a conservative part of the city, depending also if it was more an international crowd or more Turkish crowd, you adapted because again, you have this notion of culture that's different in Moscow, usually in Russia. It's fine. Women would dress, at least when I was living there, maybe it changed, but nobody was looking at you. Men were at some point either too drunk or not truly interested because there is a shortage of men. So it's not the men running after you, women. Mm-hmm. It's more the women were running after men in Russia. The demographic situation is a bit different. But I had never had problems. On the contrary, you had even grandmothers telling me, oh, you need to wear heels, you need to dress up in order to find good husbands and blah, blah, blah. Okay, you would never see a Turkish grandmother telling you need to wear short skirts and high heels because it makes you look more beautiful and more attractive to men. The position women have in the society, how they perceived, and how they can also express their femininity. And it really differs from country to country. It's not even the same in France and even in Europe. If you compare London, Paris, or Milan, it's not going to be the same thing.
No, it's fun sometimes to take inspiration from the different ways that people do it and express it. There are ways in which I'm honestly very grateful that my years in Turkey influenced my style. There's some beautiful ways of drape and color and the little details that Turkish women like to wear, especially back in the 2010s when we were there, that I really love and I really agree to appreciate a certain femininity that they had. So obviously women's style around the world has drastically changed over the centuries and you've been studying this. When would you say a modern style period began and what has that meant for women dressing for different occasions from work to play?
I would say that there was one particular century that needs to be pinpointed in order to understand what has been happening during the 20th century and what's currently happening during the 21st century. It's the 19th century. The 19th century is really a turning point in the way, particularly when it comes to women's fashion, in the way things started to change for different reasons. The first one is that at the end of the previous century, you had a political event that everybody knows about, the French Revolution. So we could think that the French Revolution was just for France, But it did have some impacts also abroad in Europe. What happened during the French Revolution, apart from beheading the king and the queen in this order, is that you had the abolition of privileges. And as part of that, you had the abolition of the sumptuary laws. These were laws which would say what you could wear, what kind of fabrics, what kind of embellishments you could have, depending on your social belonging, depending on your status and quality, as they say usually in the laws. So if you were part of the elite, if you are part of the aristocracy, and again, depending on which level of the aristocracy, you could have access to silk, you could have access to brocade, to gold thread embroideries, and so on and so forth. If you were belonging to the bourgeoisie, if you were belonging to the working class, you didn't have access to this, because at some point these laws were here to reinforce the social recognition through garments. As I told you a bit very briefly at the beginning, fashion and the way we dress is a nonverbal communication. Consequently, they could already guess who you were and how they could also address to you. The French revolutionaries, what they wanted to achieve, in fact, is to make sure that equality was for everybody, not just equality when it comes to belongings, but also when it comes to how you dress. What they did do for women was to get rid of the corset. They got rid of the panier, this kind of big structure which would give the characteristic shape of the Rococo dresses, mm-hmm. the French style dress. You also had the Polish style dress. You had always a kind of understructure.
Yeah.
The French revolutionary said, no, we don't want that anymore, because it's preventing freedom of movement. So you still have this notion of freedom, which was important, though you were a woman. But it's interesting. If you look at the beginning of the 19th century, fashion for women is very comfortable.
Yes. So instead of these big panier dresses, to help us imagine, if you haven't seen these types of dresses, what did it start to look like there? You know, like you said, there are these cages, right?
Well, if you look at the beginning of the 18th century pre-French Revolution, you need to imagine Marie Antoinette. She's everywhere in France currently. There are at least two exhibitions, if I'm not mistaken, even three exhibitions going in the 18th century. You have this very beautiful movie from Sofia Coppola.
Yes.
So you will have the understanding of how women would dress before the revolution. Beginning of the 19th century, to give you an idea, you need to look at Bridgerton. Even if it's not like 100% historically accurate in terms of costume designs, you have the idea. It's high-waisted dress. So if you look at the fashion history from the French side, we would say it's empire dress, because mm-hmm. it corresponds to the first empire and Napoleon Bonaparte. If you look at the English side, it's the Regency dress, because it corresponds to the Regency period. But still, the dress is the same. You have a very high waist dress. You don't have any volumes. It's very lean. You had a kind of rigidity at the breast level. It's not really a corset. So don't get abused by people showing you corsets in Bridgerton for the beginning of the 19th century, because it's not accurate. Here you don't have understructure. Sometimes it was even so transparent that people were complaining, oh, look, we see. Ooh, we need to hide. So that's how you have the first bottom undergarments. But then it started to change.
I was going to say, we don't stay that way, though, because you're describing the pannier. I'm like, oh, but wait, but it comes back in a different shape, right?
This period lasted 15 years, roughly. And then after, slowly, if you look at portraits, if you look at fashion magazines, engravings, you see that slowly fashion started to become more and more rigid, more and more voluminous. And here, you have to thank the Industrial Revolution.
Really? So what happens?
You had entrepreneurs in the steel industry who wanted to earn a bit more money. You produce, you want to make sure that people were going to consume and to come back consuming. So they did three things, which led to the comeback of different items, particularly in the women's wardrobe. One of them is linked with the corset. Before, in order to fasten your corset, you didn't have a steel round to make sure that the fabric won't tear. Mm-hmm. So one genius said, oh, but let's put eyelets in metal in the corset. So this brought back the corset. The heels also tended to disappear between the end of the French Revolution and the 1810s. Again, a person said, let's put some metal heels.
I see.
And now the crinoline. So usually when we think about the 18th century, we have these big voluminous tresses coming in mind. You can think about Queen Victoria, Empress Eugenie. The Victorian era most of the time is associated with the crinolines. And why did we have the comeback of this understructure? Again, steel entrepreneurs says, okay, we need to find ways to sell more.
So you're telling me capitalism is the reason for this fashion style, the lobster tail fashion style that we see in 1890s into 1900s dresses?
Yeah, particularly starting from the mid of the 19th century, you can definitely draw a parallel between the boom of capitalism and production and the complexification of females' wardrobe. It's not the only thing. This is also during that period that fashion started to be considered superficial in a sense. If you compare men and women during that period, men, it's very boring. It's black. It's very simple. It starts to be very comfortable also for them. And for women, it starts to be complex because women were used by men as a way to display their wealth. And if the crinoline started to reach crazy volumes, it was also, look, I have the money to make sure that the women of my family can wear all these crazy garments because it costs a lot of money to have to pay for these fabrics and to have these voluminous dresses. And it's not over.
Oh boy, what else?
It's not over because indeed during the 19th century, women had to change several times, particularly when it comes to the bourgeoisie.
I was going to say probably depending on their social class, if they were higher up, they probably had to change multiple times. So what were the modes of the day in which they had to change what they were wearing and what would they wear?
You had to change at least 5 times a day, not counting sports activities, because it's also during the 19th century that sports activities started to rise and to be more and more practiced.
I was thinking this is a very lucrative trade to have housemaids and ladies' maids and all of these different servants to help you get in and out of these garments, especially if you have these hooks and all the different pieces to them and things like that. But to think about changing 5 times a day, was this, again, was this capitalism at play? Was this sociology at play? Who started this notion? And when did this start to fall apart? Because how long were people still having 5 different outfits a day?
Maybe not 5.
Okay.
But this practice of changing, honestly, I also had it in my family. When I was going to school, I was dressed a certain way. When I get back from school, I had to change in another type of outfit. If there were people coming over for lunch or for dinner, you would dress up a bit. If you were going to the cinema, if you were going to the theater, you would dress up also. So you would adapt, in fact, the way you dress depending on the activity, not to the extreme of what was happening for women during the 19th century, but I was born during the 1980s. I was raised like that. And it's true that when I am at home, I'm dressed more relaxed. If I need to go out, I would change.
In Greece, it's quite common to wear pajamas at home. And I grew up with the notion also of home clothes. And we would do the same thing. We'd change out of whatever clothes we wore at school into something that was not as nice and whatever over the weekend. But I say this as knowing that I don't actually know what the typical, and I say this in air quotes right now, American experience is, or Western European experiences, because I recognize that my family has its own microcosm and bubble that is a window into another part of the world.
No, but it's true that I would say that it's European, because even the home clothes are not pajamas. You would dress after for the night, which was a completely different way of dress. So I guess we still kept that. It's not something that it's common nowadays. It depends on the people. It depends on also on your own behavior. I know that I like to dress differently depending on the occasion.
Me too.
Depending on the type of people, depending on what I will be doing. But it's not necessarily the case for everybody. And this practice of changing depending on the occasions went on throughout the 20th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, it was still pretty common before the First World War. But already we start to see that there is a simplification of dress. Here you have to take into consideration that during the 19th century, you have sports activities which would develop, both for men and women, in fact. Nowadays, we do see the difference between like sports sportswear and like day wear, and we tend to dress during the day with sportswear. But back in the time, I wouldn't say that it was necessarily a more comfortably cut or something like that. It was just, okay, these are the pants for hunting, for playing golf. And this influence of, now we call it sportswear, but this influence of sports activities became stronger and stronger throughout the 20th century. And of course, by the end of the 20th century, it was the reign of sportswear. And nowadays, it's streetwear. If you look at the last Louis Vuitton's fashion show, it's for men. It's completely sportswear.
So we've gone into, in the 20th century, it's very unstructured. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm assuming women's roles in society and what they're doing and the emergence of, is it actually the emergence of more women working outside the house? No, because women were working this whole time.
Women were working, but what happened with the 20th century is that more and more women started to work, and not just working class women. You also had women from higher social groups who would start working. Before, working for women was a sign of poverty, but during the First World War in Europe, men were mobilized, they were fighting on the fronts, and women stayed in the back, and they in fact run the countries, they run the companies that their husbands or all the men left. And after that, they understood that they could be independent. And they didn't need a man to support them financially. So it was a big discovery, not discovery, but a big realization. Okay, I can do it myself. It's not because I'm poor, am I coming from a poor background, that I need to work. It's because by working, I can also gain independence from men. And throughout the 1920s, the 1930s, you have more and more women, in fact, taking on positions. Not because they had to necessarily, but because they wanted to, because it brought them a certain level of independence. And this is interesting also to notice. Throughout the 20th century in Western Europe, I would say in Western Europe because this is what I'm more familiar with, but in other countries, in other regions, something that you can also notice. But women were working, they were more independent financially, and you can also notice that the dresses became simpler.
Freedom of movement again.
Again. The French revolutionaries were on something.
And then we have, of course, after World War II, the new look and a return to a more structured look for women.
Yeah, it's interesting to compare. It's Christian Dior who launched the new look in 1947. And it's interesting because also to understand why he brought back this crinoline-inspired dresses, because they were inspired by the crinoline. You have different elements to take into consideration, all linked with also the personal history of Christian Dior. So Christian Dior was born at the beginning of the 20th century in a wealthy family in Normandy, with flowers, with his mother, his sister, and was influenced by this kind of romantic era, the past is beautiful. Then after his family went bankrupt, he started to work for different designers during the war. He would work with Lucien Lelon, who would after train many designers who would start in the 1950s. And he also had a sister, Catherine Dior, who was part of the French Resistance. And his sister got arrested by the Gestapo during the very last days of the war, weeks before the liberalization of Paris. And she got arrested, she got tortured, she got sent to a concentration camp. It was the last convoy which went there. So he was very afraid of never seeing his sister again. So fine, it was with the Red Cross, they managed to find her, she was alive. And when he learned when she would arrive in Paris, so he waited for her, and he was just with a big bucket of flour because he was raised like that. And he didn't know how to react because you can imagine she spent months in the concentration camp. She had many health issues. When he saw her looking like a skeleton, he got scared. And many people, in fact, got scared by seeing what was happening, plus the fashion during the Second World War for women, which was not feminine at all, very much inspired by the military uniforms. So he was reacting to this by saying, okay, let's bring back femininity. Hmm. Let's bring back women as flowers, as it was during the 19th century. And that's why you had the bar jacket, the full skirts. It was for him a way to bring back this notion of sweetness, of calmness.
Of comfort.
Exactly.
It sounds like nostalgia.
Exactly. It was completely nostalgia for him.
I think we have to talk about fashion today. We had a conversation before this formal interview about how it seems at the moment that fashion doesn't have a cohesion to it, or there are many different trends that are happening at once. We haven't even talked about fast fashion. You mentioned it with the Industrial Revolution of making it easier and quicker for people, but now it's indisputable. It's at a fever pitch of how quickly fast fashion turns out different trends and designs, and then it's gone. So what do you see going on right now?
I understand that it's not as easy to define what is fashion today as it was for the past, where you had from decade to decade a particular style, in fact. Okay, you can say it's the 1920s, it's 1930s, and then it's 1980s, it's 1970s, you can say that. But can you say it's the 2020s, it's the 2010s? It's another question. Fashion is a cycle. It always feeds itself with the past and re-ingurgitate it with today's society. And what is today's society? Internet, the rise of social media, a faster communication, a faster production also. So you see more and more practices from the 20th century and any kind of decade, even like from the 18th century, even like from the 16th century, coming back and being given another shape. And this is what is fashion. So the way we communicate, the speed that we have to produce, maybe also at some point the impact of climate change, the geopolitical events, which are very strong for the past years, also impact fashion. The fact that you don't have just one center of fashion, which was Western Europe, but you have now different hubs with their own identity, with their own culture coming from former colonies. And they want to also be part of the discussion. So when I ask students, what is fashion? How do you describe fashion today? They say, oh yeah, we take it, we blend it, and we give it some, we give another shape. And it changes almost every day because of social media, TikTok, for example. When it comes to new trends and being adopted by billions of people, it's on TikTok.
I've seen this as an accusation online or indictment online that no one has original style anymore because everyone is copying each other from social media, rushing from to copy it literally from head to toe. And we said earlier in this conversation, our styles are in some ways are still about blending in. Some people dress to stand out, but generally as people, as societies, that's what we do to feel like we have some sort of in-group or that we belong. So do you think it's true that there's no originality anymore, or is this a moot point?
We need to define what is originality. Originality in 2026 might not be the same as it was at the end of the 20th century. If I say to my fashion students that the style is not original, while I do see that they put efforts to stand out, I will be killed. I mean, I would be beheaded. Honestly, they would put a guillotine in the campus. They will come for me. So what is originality? Because maybe originality for them is not the same as what it is for me and for you. Maybe for them, originality is to bring back, I don't like it, but say, yeah, it's vintage from the 1990s. And I was, no, it's not vintage. I'm not vintage. You have the fact that this new generation, the Gen Z, and then you'll have Gen Alpha, they don't live on the same time zone, I would say, almost than we do.
Oh, absolutely. We all grew up through very different historical events. And so that is absolutely influenced. I mean, the 90s, I think about my own antipathy to it, is that in the 1990s, I was an adolescent. So I see those clothes. And for me, it evokes the emotional reaction. I was the most awkward during that time period. Oh, so yeah. I see them and I'm like, oh no, we're not doing this again, even though I am not that person anymore. But it's different. I love 1960s, 70s clothes. I never lived through that time period, but because I didn't, I just see the clothes as how cool they are.
And that's why it's difficult for me to do fashion history for today, because, you know, I was born in the 1980s, so I saw the last decades of the 20th century, I saw the turning to the 21st century, and I'm going to live for another few decades of the 21st century. It's easier for me to look at my mother's time, at my grandmother's time, because indeed, as you said, I wasn't born.
Absolutely.
But to come back to today's fashion and how to define fashion, fashion is linked with society. And for that, there is a quote from Gabrielle Chanel that I like very much, and I wrote it down. She says that fashion is not something that exists in dresses only. Fashion is in the sky, is in the street. Fashion has to do with ideas, the way we live, what is happening. And she was true. It's what is fashion. So when you want to understand a certain practice, you need to see the society at large. So if we try to understand what's happening today in fashion and why we have all these things going together, we don't know where it goes. Are we tending towards something gender-free, something where everybody will be dressed the same way? And as we are internationally connected, that's pretty new in human history to have so fast connections. Well, look, you're in the States, I'm in France, so it's the beauty of technology. Of course, it makes fashion even more faster. And when it comes to fast fashion, this is also something that we didn't really talk about.
I would love to have you back on to talk about fast fashion and sustainability and climate change. We could do, and we should do, a whole episode on that. And how much I find in looking at these big questions, it feels like there's a big tension between how much we can do as individuals and how much the onus of this is on corporations and governments. I would love to have a big discussion about all of those things. So yes, not today for fast fashion, but yes, fast fashion is another aspect of talking about this. I've got a listener question for you.
Oh, sure.
Hi, Catherine. My name is Afton. I graduated with a degree in art history. And after looking at all of your experience, I'm just in awe. You've done so much research and work with women around the world from all different backgrounds, all different cultures, all areas of the world. And I'm just curious to know if you see a common theme that ties all of us women together and how we can really use that information to keep evolving as the next generation of women in the world today. Fashion is something that is so unique to every person, but I'm curious if you found any common themes of what truly ties us together as women around the world.
Thank you very much for your question. It's a very interesting one. You know, what I've noticed, no matter the period of time, no matter the century you're talking about, no matter the culture, no matter the country of origin, there is indeed one thing that link women together. It's the wish to be beautiful. And beauty can be translated in so many ways. Of course, 16th century beauty is not the same as 21st century beauty, but the notion of I want to feel beautiful, I want to show off who I am or what kind of person I want to be perceived. I think that wishing to be beautiful is the common thread that we all have as women.
So I've got two more questions to close this out. One, how can people develop their own style? And two, in order to do that, what do you recommend people read, watch, listen to, and go see to learn about fashion history?
For the first question, which was on how to work on one's personal style, what I would like to answer is really to be open to inspiration, to allow oneself to be inspired as a starting point, to experiment, to see what other people around you wear, and to try and what fits, what feels natural to your personality, to your body type also, and what doesn't, so that after you can select, okay, this is what I want to keep, and this is what I don't want to keep. I'm not going to tell you need to wear such and such brand because it's not relevant for me, because brand is not style. But if you want to really work on your personal style, get inspired. Then after, when it comes to reading recommendations, so of course you have Auguste Racinet. So it's maybe one of the first 19th century historians. So you need to take some distance, but still it's a starting point from the 1960s, where you had a revival of fashion as a sociological topic. So you had James Laver and François Boucher. These two people wrote fashion history books. And after, if you are more into the semiology of fashion, you have again a sociologist from the beginning of the 20th century who discoursed about what is fashion.
What's his name?
Daniel Roche. He wrote a lot about the cult of appearance, starting from the 18th century, and of course he will talk about the 19th century. Then what I would encourage you to do is to read biographies and autobiographies of designers from the 20th century, because this is where you start having people writing about themselves. You have an insight about their lives, you can understand what makes their houses so important even nowadays, and you also have an idea about the time in which they were living and how they reacted to that time. I would also recommend to watch documentaries. There is one that I like to watch with my fashion marketing students. It's a documentary on Diana Vreeland. So Diana Vreeland is the first Anna Wintour, and she put Vogue on the radar, she put the Met Gala. You will watch the documentary, you will have an idea about her personality. She was crazy, but sometimes you need this type of crazy people. And also, she was born at the beginning of the 20th century, and she died at the end of the 20th century. It gives also an idea about what kind of society influenced her and how she was able after in the second half of the 20th century to influence the society. And you have podcasts. I have my own podcast. It can be interesting for you also to listen to it. There are also two fashion historians having their own podcast. It's called Dress, the History of Fashion. Then you have the museum at FIT, and they also have a very interesting podcast. They have a YouTube channel. Most of the time it touches on a more modern fashion history. I remember one day they did a YouTube online conference on sneakers, for example. I will gather all this information for you to be able to consult after on the Substack.
Fantastic. I think this is a treasure trove of resources to go into and fun things to see. I think I've seen that documentary on Diana Vreeland and very much enjoyed it many years ago. So I think the listeners will as well. And I want to thank you for coming on our Pandora's Box today. This has been, for me, a really lovely discussion, a lot of fun. I love clothes. I love looking not just at what they actually look at and letting the eye travel, as Vreeland would say, but also getting to touch the garments and touch the accessories and describe them as I did earlier in my career when I was doing some of that writing.
Thank you very much, Maria. It was really a true pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having thought about me. And I hope that this episode would be useful for your audience. And I'm looking forward to talk to you again.
Thank you. Me too. Thank you all for listening today to this episode of Our Pandora's Box. I hope you got as much out of it as I did. I had a lot of fun both in reminiscing and delving into our Istanbul days, as well as learning about the impacts of business on the things that we wear. You can continue learning more about the conversation that we had today on Substack, where we have an amazing list of resources that Catherine hinted at. So come over there, have a read, leave a voice note, or tell us what you think so we can shape future episodes. Our Pandora's Box is a Pentelic Productions podcast that was created, hosted, produced, and edited by yours truly, Maria Iliadis. Thanks again for joining us, and don't forget to stay hopeful and stay curious. I'll see you soon on the next Our Pandora's Box.